I woke up this morning having seen Underdog, the other Bronte sister last night, thinking about how you can always write different reviews. It's a very odd thing about being a writer. There's always in your head sort of not necessarily alternate views, but alternate starting points. And so I grew up loving the Bronte sisters and really reading all the books about them. And I've followed, so I followed it down the years, the sort of debates, the scholarly debates about which Bronte sister's good and which is bad. I loved Emily, as I think was fashionable in the 70s.
Yes.
With Wuthering Heights and Kate Bush and all of that. I think that was the high point of
my dad was always obsessed with Brownwell.
Oh, there you go.
And just, you know, the forgotten brother.
Yeah.
I think that's, but that, maybe that says something else, but anyway.
And now this play by Sarah Gordon is very much plugging into the idea that Anne is the forgotten sister.
Oh, right, okay.
And that Tennant of Wildfell Hall is the great sort of undiscovered novel, the realist novel. Have you ever read Tennant of Wildfell Hall?
No, never.
No, nor have I.
I never was obsessed with the Brontes. I don't know why. I think I was much more of a sort of Henry Sugar, slightly racier, offbeat sort of novel reader.
I was terrible, sort of romantic northerner. And also, I suppose actually in my background, I we did go to Howarth and look at the parsonage and sort of pay homage. Actually, before it was like it is now, when it was really a kind of cold and drafty and really hideous parsonage rather than just being a museum. But I think I definitely empathise with that idea of being stuck on the moors.
Yes, yes.
And it took me years and years to realise that Heathcliff really isn't a romantic hero, that he is actually kind of a brute and so on. I think I was very much sucked into it all. So it was a fascinating play. But the thing I was thinking this morning was that I could have written that. So I could have written what I've just said to you.
Yes.
And said, you know, this is my background, this is my relationship with the Brontes. And that would have been a perfectly good way of writing about it. And I was thinking about writing it about that way. And then actually I've written a slightly different review, which is more about, which is less personal. And it's always fascinates me that you can just choose different ways of writing about things, really. And I don't know if I've never asked other critics if they kind of weigh up the different intros and different ways into things. I think it's,
So
this morning, in fact, I took the more sort of slightly more distanced. I didn't mention my own interest in the Brontes.
Right.
So I took I actually described the play, which I think is good, but a bit of a conundrum because I feel it doesn't quite get under the skin of what it's saying.
Right.
It's got brilliant, it's very funny.
Yes.
And it's got a brilliant central performance from Gemma Whelan, who sort of turns Charlotte into kind of sympathetic monster.
Yes.
Very good, very clever performance.
I think we are obsessed, aren't we? Or most people are obsessed with families that create more than one sort of literary phenomenon. And the idea of what that house must have been like. I mean, they lost their mum quite early.
Yeah,
they're
motherless. Yeah, motherless children. Yeah,
and the dad was a
dad was a clergyman.
Yeah.
And very sort of hardline clergyman.
Because I went to their house as well. And I remember. I mean, it's interesting. It's so
and they're all dying of TB. I mean, the older siblings all die of TB.
So yeah,
TB is just like rife in the house. You know.
But that's extraordinary. I mean, it's like Little Women. It's sort of they're all amazing. And so that existence in itself is enough for a novel, has been enough for a novel, enough for a play. You know, any kind of, I mean, I remember reading about Katharine Hepburn's family and there is sort of extraordinary, you couldn't sit at the dinner table unless you had something interesting to say.
Yeah.
And if you were going to debate or question, you had to sit the argument out. That was the rule. And the idea of, you know, living in a house like that, the intensity of it, is amazing.
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated with them as much as I am by the books. I mean, yeah, it wasn't necessarily something I was drawn to as a youth, but they are brilliant.
Yeah.
And just amazing. I suppose it's that, isn't it? And our fascination with them continues. And as I mentioned, the brother Brownwell, and that he was, think, an alcoholic.
Yeah, he was an alcoholic, and drug addict as well. And just, dissolute. He's always, you know, really spent all the family money, spent all the sister's money.
Yeah.
And they of course, spend a lot of time caring for him until he too dies of TB. And there's a very funny joke in this play, which I suspect is to some extent true, which about his famous portrait of them, which is now in the National Portrait Gallery. Yeah. And they do the joke about, you know, Bramwell coming on saying, I want to be in the National Portrait Gallery.
Oh, right.
Of course, he's ended up there, but not because he was famous, but because his sisters were famous. But also that Charlotte hates her depiction in it because her nose is too big. And it's sort of ongoing and a rather good joke.
Yeah.
And Anne, who is the other Bronte, is the pretty one. And it is fascinating. And it's a good moment. It's a good way to start this week's episode of As the Actress Said to the Critic, with me, the critic, Sarah Crompton.
And with me, the actress, Nancy Carroll.
Because the other thing I've seen this week is Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Right.
Which, of course, is another autobiographical play.
Yes.
About a family where everybody's competing around the dinner table, essentially.
Yeah. Though,
interestingly, you never see them eating. You always see them after meals.
Yeah.
Eugene O'Neill.
It's extraordinary.
Play.
Yeah, but sprawling and extraordinary. And we were talking about it. It's interesting that American period drama still has this sort of fascination for us. And is seen to be other still. It's still, it sounds so obvious to say, but you know that whole thing about divided by a foreign language or, no, what's
divided by a common language.
Divided by a common language, that's right. That we have this fascination with America and particularly at that time, everything seemed bigger and wider and louder and... I don't know, just but
more significant. I think that idea that the family can carry all the significance of the world is really writ large in American drama of the early 20th century. I think.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. I went with someone who has never seen it before, and I went obviously because it's new production. It stars Brian Cox, hot off his Succession fame, and very much, you know, again playing a paterfamilias who. Is distorting his children's lives.
Yeah.
It's got Patricia Clarkson as his drug-addicted wife, Mary, and Laurie Kynaston and Daryl McCormick as the sons, who are, again, in different ways, being destroyed by this family. And I went, having seen loads and loads of productions of it, and thinking, oh, will it be really interesting to work out all the different ways in which this works? Directed by friend of the pod, Jeremy Herron.
Yeah.
And so I'm there, like, I am really in a critic's hat. I'm really, really there to make judgments about how it's being done. I went with a friend who'd never seen it before.
Yeah.
And was, by the end of what is, you know, it's a fair description, a long day's journey.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long play. It's nearly 3.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was completely sort of seduced and entranced by the way the story unfolds. As indeed was I, you know, by the, you just kind of, it's one of those plays you kind of lean into and wait for it to unfold, all the sense of waste and loss that addiction can cause. And actually, it's a play about love. You know, they do love each other, this family. They're not, they may be at war and they may kind of take out their resentments on one another.
Yeah.
But they are full of love. And I think it's an astonishing play, really, and always really glad to see it.
Yeah.
Done quite recently, Richard Eyre did a production.
Yeah, with Jeremy Irons and, was it Leslie Manville?
Leslie Manville as Mary, yes.
That opened at Bristol and then came in.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating. And I think it must be a fascination for actors if you're lucky enough to still be working, you know, at any stage, but particularly as you get older, there are these great sort of mecha roles.
Yeah.
And that Eugene O'Neill has so many of them. But All My Sons and all those great family dramas that we still do in this country, and sometimes with American and English casts working together, that sometimes go back over the pond to Broadway and stuff. And so there is a sort of mutual love of it. But I am interested in this, what it is that you bring to something having grown up in a completely different culture.
Yeah,
you know, and it's one thing to sort of perfect the accent. A lot of those plays play on submerged emotions, you know, things that you don't talk about, people, you know, undiagnosed PTSD after the wars, you know, people dealing with the fallout, as you say, of drug addiction and stuff like that. And there's one thing that we, that all of those sorts of plays, English as well, do very, very well is deal with the undealt with.
Yeah.
And so there is, you know, that is completely shared, but there is, there's something other.
Yeah.
And always available to tackle with fresh eyes, which is just brilliant.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I will. And I think
Well, what's so interesting about this particular production is that Cox is, you know, an English. No, he's not. Cox is a Scottish actor.
Scott.
Yeah. Proud Scottish actor.
Bad accent.
And he,
mine. Not.
And he effectively is adopting the voice that. He was so convincing in Succession, and it's very much sort of that voice. You can hear kind of American accent within it. He's playing an actor, which is why actors love playing James Tyrone, I think, because, you know, the whole point about Tyrone is that he's an actor who has sold his talent for fame and that he's driven by a fear of poverty. And Cox gave a lot of interviews in which he said that he felt that he understood that idea of being really, really scared of the insecurity of poverty.
Yeah.
And that's very much a theme of the production. You feel it quite strongly. The set is deliberately very bare.
Right.
And when Mary talks about always being deprived of a home, you actually really feel it. There's one cushion that everybody moves around. You know, that it's not a comfortable place to be, this summer house in Connecticut. So that's a very strong thread. But then Clarkson, American actress, you know, not that well known here, known on telly and in film, not that well known. And she brings a very particular sensibility to Mary. And the other thing that strikes me about it, I was talking to another friend about it, is that it's odd that it's a play built around three men, and all of the men, particularly James Tyrone and the younger son Edmund, who is the autobiographical figure, who the poet and the writer. They're meant to be the leads in it. But the way it's structured is like a sort of quartet or a chorale. And Mary is very, very often the voice that emerges as the strongest voice, that somehow her part offers such rich opportunities.
Yeah.
Even though on paper you might think it's not about her at all. And Clarkson found this very, to me, really interesting thing of playing it very realistically, anti-poetically, and letting her be, you know, an addict. So going through all those kind of stages of sort of joy and denial and anger and regret and nostalgia, and bringing them into a kind of very detailed, quite jerky performance that gradually goes into a very slow, sad decline towards the end. And yeah, it was very, really interesting to see. And when we both saw the Leslie Manville one again, I loved Jeremy Irons in it, and I thought he was terrific.
Yeah.
And kind of believable as an actor. You know, I loved that side of it. But it's Manville's performance that I think about a lot.
And I think there's something devastating to watch, isn't there, as an audience, when a family normalise a sort of drawn out trauma like addiction. You know, when a family are dealing with anything like terminal illness or addiction or any level of unhappiness or disease, but it's become part of their everyday, it's such an uncomfortable thing to watch.
Yeah.
And that the drama for nothing, just in that very basic story, whatever you add in terms of personalities and personal history and, you know, and then just the brilliance of certain writers, it's so awful.
Yes.
And depending on how Mary is depicted and the detail and the fallout, whether there's, you know, the sort of cold turkey element of not having had a fix that day or whatever the story is at that particular part of the play, it's the drama of watching everybody relate to that.
Is
not talked about, but that in itself, I mean, it's real and palpable, and Yeah, anyway, I didn't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think that's very much how Jeremy's directed it. I mean, yeah, I really feel that. I felt, you know, so you're always, if you're watching a kind of classic done again, you're always looking for the thing that makes it different than the last time you saw it. And I really felt that that was the conversation that they'd had. I don't know if they did have it in the rehearsal room, but how every one of their behaviours, of the men's behaviour, is to reflect that kind of distorting mirror in the centre. That...
But amazing for him as well. Sorry, I'm interrupting. No. But I just suddenly had a thought, which is that amazing for him to be putting people, places and things back on the stage at the same time that has such similar themes.
Yes.
You know, and also that sort of, that mirror of family and medical help around somebody coping with addiction.
Yeah.
You know, and Denise Goff was so extraordinary. I'm not surprised that they're wanting to revive that again, because there were so many people who say, oh God, I wish I'd seen it, and now they can. And the brilliant Sinead Cusack is in it. And
right, and Duncan McMillan's play. And it is a wonderful play. I hadn't thought of that, and it's really true, because Jeremy's directing it again, and it will be really interesting as like a...
Prism.
Yeah, modern prism.
For him to sort of have those two things in conjunction, how they must speak to him in parallel as a director, thinking, well, actually, you are reviving a period drama, but there's so much about those themes that just... are timeless.
Timeless.
And
And I think that is the thing about those classic American dramas of the early 20th century, that there are issues around them. And I feel that, again, you know, rather like the Brontes, my view of them has changed a lot down the years. So, that, you know, I did really grow up revering O'Neill and Miller and Tennessee Williams, all slightly different stories. But, and then later on, you know, with kind of thinking about the male view of the world, sort of, and certainly some of the aspects of their lives that you discover.
Yeah.
You think you as a woman worry about certain aspects. Certainly with Miller, I think my view of him as a person has changed down the years. But still, when you go to see the plays, actually, they're so beautifully written.
Yeah.
And with such, you know, with great productions, such sort of eternal verities do emerge from them, and they very often emerge through the mouths of the women characters.
Yeah,
even though they're plays dominated by men. I mean, if I think about All My Sons, which is about a man who has done a terrible thing in the war, which has killed all my sons, the great speeches that you remember in it are not just his of sort of guilt, but of his wife. Explaining the effect on their lives.
And again,
you know, a kind of figure who's been thinned into nothing in Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
It's Willie Loman's wife, Linda, who gets, you know, the great, in many ways, the great speeches, you know, attention must be paid to this man. And so she's got that kind of choric quality, where she does explain what the story means to a large extent. I mean, she is the person who puts it into context and makes it have the truthfulness.
I mean, you, exactly as you say, and also, I mean, we are always saying, oh, the men's part and the women's part, and there is an imbalance in those plays, and that often someone who sits slightly removed, either because they are the homemaker or, you know, the child rearer or whatever it is, that they are given that moment to comment. But really, you know, it's a play about those planets circling each other and how they affect each other, and the space between those planets, and how history and consequence and saying or not saying directly affects the people around you. I mean, that's the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe there'll be a time in the future, and I think we're experimenting with it, with gender fluidity around casting and stuff, just because then you hear the words and it's not the woman saying the words. Yeah. And I don't mean to sound critical of what you're saying, because that's how we all see it. But, you know, the words are so beautiful and the words are shared. You know, the thoughts are shared. It's just you have one spokesperson who is brave enough to actually voice it and, yeah. and articulate the trauma or the tension or the grief or whatever it is in those big sprawling dramas. You know, you get it gets to a boiling point and somebody says, this is what's going on, guys.
Yeah.
There isn't necessarily the solution by voicing, but you voice it. Because, and you know, presumably people, the audiences at the time it was written will have had so many similar stories in their house and not be able to articulate, you know, whatever it is that they're going through. And that's what's so amazing, particularly after the war, particularly in those sort of cast iron class structures that people daren't step away from. And that's the story, isn't it?
You know, yeah, yeah.
And they are so fascinating. The parts are, yes, it's the woman part in a patriarchy household and all the rest of it, but it is, I don't know, there's something other that still needs to be explored about the journey that gets you to the point where you have to articulate the tension in the room.
Yeah.
And and that for a performer, for an audience member who's been through something, is always the fascination.
Yeah. Isn't
it? And Jeremy Herron is always so brilliant about, I think, marking the pace of how that unravels.
Yeah.
Lots of people are brilliant at it, but he is. Yeah, he's no, got he a is great really knack. Good.
And I think, you know, I do think the direction of this is great. And actually, it makes me think slightly randomly, but of something else that I read this week, that Jess Butterworth gave a really interesting interview about writing The Hills of California.
Right.
And he hasn't really talked very much about it. And he talked about how he has, in writing it, used all kinds of aspects of his own experience to go into a play that is unlike his own experience, but draws on that. So yeah. He does actually sort of explain that kind of creative process where lots of things that you have felt go into a crucible where they come out slightly differently. So he talks about the death of his sister. He talks about his dealings with Harvey Weinstein and who he punched, which I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
So he punched him because Weinstein punched somebody and he said, right, if you want to fight, I'll fight. And he punched him, which is a brilliant story on Birthday Girl, his film with Nicole Kidman. And he also talked about overhearing a conversation somewhere and thinking that's very like Greek drama. And you realise that in the crucible of creativity, all those things are coming in to one pot. And it ends up sounding sort of Greek, you know.
So, yeah, yeah.
So reaching back into, you know, the origins of playwriting.
Yeah.
Which I do, again, which is why I do think those American writers of that of the early turn of the century into the into the 50s did see themselves consciously treading in that canon of Greek drama. I mean, yeah, you know, yeah. they are structured that way.
Yeah.
Which gives you the opportunity to make your correction.
Oh, yes.
Last week.
Yeah. I had a bit of a brain fart at the time that I was actually saying the words, which is when I said that theatre had been around for 250,000 years, that what I meant was 2,500 years. And I was about to say 2,500 years. And then my brain went, no, that's wrong. And then added a zero or two, but it was 2,500 years, which is pretty extraordinary.
It's pretty extraordinary.
But it's interesting as well that we talk about writers and their influences and the Brontes, and that everything that is important now, and when we look back at what led to the creation of the words that we study endlessly and talk about and that inform so many other creative exploits, happened at a formative young age to these people, which then possibly, as a good link, leads to the cuts to higher education funding of the arts by the government, the creative arts in universities and colleges this week by the government, which is an extraordinary, extraordinarily damaging and traumatic and lots of bleep words that the government have done in their infinite wisdom.
Yeah. So Gillian Keegan, the education minister, has announced her plan.
Yeah.
To take out funding from the creative arts in universities, which is, There's a bit of me that doesn't understand it, you know, because
I've got a lot of me that doesn't understand it.
Well, I mean, I don't understand it because I don't agree with it. But I also don't understand it because it seems such a sort of self-defeating little bit of policy to announce.
Yeah.
Because it certainly cuts off everybody who, well, it cuts off half the country, really, of all the people who might want to study the creative arts.
Yes.
And a very interesting debate has sort of burst forth on Twitter. Armando Iannucci tweeted how appalling this is and pointing out how much the creative arts contributes to the economy and says that, you know, it is more than, you know, heavy industry in terms of turnover and excellence and all the rest of it. And then a Tory MP who, I forgive me, whose name I can't find, tweeted back saying, you know, you've miscalculating this, but then went on to say something that really interested me, which is he says that the reason that you would take funding out of universities for the creative arts is that on the whole, creative arts graduates go into less well-paid jobs and they can't pay back their student loans for at least 10 years. And I thought that's the most astonishing definition of value that I've ever read. So that reduces education to something that is only worth...
Well, it's financial.
Financial.
Yeah.
And, you know, and education is not that. You cannot believe that education is only to provide people to work in jobs that pay you money.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different facets to the largeness of this problem. You know, one of them is, you know, as somebody that benefited from a full grant at university, I can... That the whole argument about having to pay for education is one thing.
Yeah.
So the student loans, okay, that's a whole other debate. That's a whole other podcast.
Yes.
But also, the question is, what is education? What is learning? What is the value of giving people time to explore before the reality of life kicks in? And as you say, there are... What is it that these people are then supposed to study if they do actually want to be writers and producers and filmmakers and novelists and journalists and artists and, you know, all the people that are part of the industry that gives back to the government? What do they study?
Yeah.
Physics?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what is it that they're supposed to do? Or are they supposed to just get a job? You know, just an apprenticeship. Okay, then create a culture of apprenticeships. Do something other than to just remove the whole of arts from, you know, all the funding that allows these departments to exist. And what are all those people going to do for jobs who run those departments? Where are they going to go? Yeah,
exactly.
You know, it's like, oh my God.
I think it is an unbelievable act, actually. And I mean, I hope it will happen. I hope people will stop it happening. But I do think it's a misapprehension of the role of the creative arts, the role of just allowing people to think, you know, as well. Yeah. And that's the other quality of all these plays, which obviously, you know, I don't think were written by anybody who had a physics degree. And I'm not knocking physicists. I think physicists are brilliant. I watch University Challenge with admiration every week and watch the physicists know everything about the universe. And I don't know anything about the universe. I can just recognise the paintings.
Yes.
But I do think that, you know, a balanced society has to have both sides. And I do think the value of the arts, the reason Brian Cox comes back to the West End in order to do a play that was written in 1956, set in 1912, is that that play, just as much as Succession or anything else that people have been watching, gives people access to understanding. And I think that idea, that cutting off of empathy, which I think is happening across the world in all countries at the moment, is so dangerous. And theatre is opposite to that. It is an empathy machine, as you've said. It explains stuff to you. And that's why we keep returning to those plays.
But if you literally come out of the womb, and I do believe this, people sort of come out not entirely fully formed, but you're... whatever it is that goes on in your brain finds a way to express itself at different rates. You know, some people, you know, some writers know at like 8 that they want to be writers. Some people come to writing much later. Some people, you know, whatever it is that we love, we find our way to it. For a government to turn round and, you know, devalidate, unvalidate, invalidate, yeah. invalidate an entire chunk, God knows what the percentage is, but an entire chunk of society saying, we think you're not making enough money fast enough for yeah. us to fund your educational formative life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So go away, do something that makes money, that pays us money, that we can tick our boxes. And then if you have time to write on the side and your books get published, we'll talk about them at dinner parties.
Yeah.
You know, and I sort of metaphorically and literally want to wring their necks because it's just, I don't plan to commit murder anytime soon, but it's so short-sighted. It's so short-sighted, it's so destructive, it's so lacking in imagination and care.
Yeah.
And there is so much that we need as we recover from so many different things currently that is available to people through literature, through the radio, through the arts, through film. Educational programmes, through film.
Telly.
Just, you know, like... You know, all of us strangers. Just that sort of fascination with the supernatural and about, and that story of, and what we said about him talking about his mum last grief, week and yes. about grief. And there's a whole ripple effect of what All of Us Strangers has done in terms of people talking about their parents again and about reawakening sort of unfinished conversations that you can't have, but you can imagine. And where else in the world does that happen?
Yeah.
Where else in the world can you take that part of yourself, that bubble of stress or undiagnosed grief or trauma or whatever it is, and bring it out into the world and have a conversation about it?
Yeah.
There
yeah.
isn't anything.
Yeah. No, and it's so true that I think that so much with films of well, plays as well, but that way they have a provoking conversation. I mean, you know, that was so true. I don't know anyone who's seen All of Us Strangers
yeah.
and not ended up having a conversation about what they would like to say to their parents.
Yes.
And in some cases, their parents are still alive. And yeah. so they can actually have those conversations.
Yeah,
with
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
In other cases like mine, you know, that you can't have them anymore.
Yeah.
And the fact that Andrew Scott, who is so much sort of, you know, an actor of his generation, so popular, so trendy, people do adore him. They've got the opportunity to access that, to have those conversations,
yeah.
to talk about their sexuality, to talk about how they feel about things, because he's made a film. I think it's just, it's so, I know that we're advocates for the arts because that's what we do, but it breaks my heart that people don't all have access to that. And I yeah. hope that they do in some way. What we don't necessarily catch into this is music, which I think is the other way that lots of young people do express themselves, do find a way of communicating things that are beyond simple language.
Yeah.
And I think that is a help. And I think, again, you know, that's under attack, under, you know, policies that kind of close down live music venues, that stop people studying
yeah.
music at schools, that you know, think that creative arts subjects at university are a waste of time. And it's very dangerous because it's taking away a valve of expression for the whole of society, which really bothers me. And I, as I say, I just find sad. I mean,
yeah.
you get cross and I get sad. I just get really miserable about it.
Yeah.
And I hope it stops. I hope these conversations do open up and allow people just to... It's a conversation about value as a society. It's what you value.
Well, it comes down to, if you go... Because I've been to these things where, you have representatives of the government standing up and making talks about culture and how important it is and how they value the arts and how theatre in this country is extraordinary and how the work that we're able to sort of export is extraordinary and how proud they are and whatever. If you cut it off at the root, it either means that you haven't made the connection that the two are ultimately connected, that you have to educate people in order for them to have some skills in create. I mean, some people become writers, whatever, they don't need to study English at university. You know, generally, if people have a need to make stuff, they find a way to do it. But education and financial support and mentoring and guidance through education can be essential and give people the confidence to feel that they're allowed, they're permitted to do that as a job. Okay, so you either stand up on that podium and make this speech about culture whilst cutting funding to universities for the courses that allow people to make that. You either haven't made that connection, or you're lying, or you're, you know, an entire cabinet of hypocrites who actually are utterly self-serving for the whatever it is, top 0.1% of people who you deem to be the most important members of your society. Either of those isn't great.
No.
You know, and it's beyond frustrating and sad, really. It's actually quite dangerous.
Yeah.
Because the fallout is you have a lot of unemployment by all those departments that won't be able to sustain themselves. Or you have an entire generation of disenfranchised creative thinkers who are just lost.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what one lost soul does is they either, you know, do something else and find other ways to create because they have family support, or they are lost and in danger.
Yeah.
Because medically, or, you know, in terms of mental health and whatever, they don't have a place.
Yeah. And I think it, I mean, just sort of bringing this section to a close, I do think that it isn't a conservative value to do this. So I'm very struck. I'm working on something at the moment that I'm talking to someone who came to prominence or who was educated in the 80s. And what is interesting about talking to them is that they very much had that sense of being, of loving culture and not quite knowing how to access it because they came from, you know, a background that wasn't particularly cultural, though with full of people who loved singing and dancing and going to the theatre.
Yeah.
But there wasn't a kind of, they weren't middle class, there wasn't a tradition of it. The fact that they got a grant to go and study and that there was, you know, they could apply to their local authority and get paid to go on a degree course that was available to them because it was introduced around that time was a huge. It was a validation of something. And it started them off on, I can't quite say who it is, but it started them off on a world famous career that has generated more money for the British economy than you could dream of.
Yeah.
And I think that's the missing link as well, that it's that you, and that was under Thatcher. So that's not like it's, you know, it's not like this was something that was always belonged to a particular political party.
Yeah.
There was a kind of shared common ground that the culture and access to culture and being able to learn about culture and being able to study. I mean, the degree course they did was quite sort of heavyweight and not necessarily relating to how they ended up. But, you know, it was accepted that it was a good idea to have it.
And
that's what's weird now. And you're absolutely right. It is dangerous and it's incredibly sad. And I hope it will stop because I think it is cutting too many people off from the thing that, you know, has changed our lives, has made us passionate about what we do. And I think, you know, that in itself is, you know, so many people out there can find such fulfillment in different ways. Through that access. So I think that I think that's the other danger, that somehow it's being seen as a value I want it to stop being seen by anyone as being a good thing.
Yeah,
I don't think it is party political. And it's become so for reasons that escape me.
Yeah. And the other thing I just want to say is that this week there was a brilliant actor called Adrian Schiller who passed away very, very sadly and incredibly unexpectedly. And, you know, again, people sort of reacting to news of his death on social media and stuff has been extraordinary. And I mean, I knew him personally because we worked together at the RSC decades ago. He was on the job that Joe and I met on, and he was a lovely, lovely man, married with a small son, Gabriel. And it's just that thing, isn't it? That you know, the reactions to people's work posthumously, you know, and you realise that what you're doing on stage or on television or on film and all the extraordinary work that Adrian did, you know, on stage and in the last few years much more on television and stuff like that, and that all of that has a ripple effect that people silently are affected by, and then when suddenly they're taken untimely from the world, people go, oh God, but he did this thing and I saw him in that, and oh gosh, when I went to the Globe and saw his
Shylock,
in the Wanamaker, and all of that, you see that effect.
Yeah,
you know, the I mean, I mention it because I just think it's incredibly sad, and I wanted to just say his name.
Yeah.
But also in the context of what we're saying, the effect is always there. It may not shout, but it's constant.
Yeah.
You know, people make work and that work exists in people's lives, you know, in so many different ways. And yeah, that's all there is to say.
Well, I think that's true. And I think people so loved him. He did Death in Paradise, didn't he? That people loved him in and Victoria. And I think you're right that you're always touched by those deaths. You know, that, you know, back to John Donne about one death affecting everybody. And I think that is it's another way that you're bound together as a society, of a sense of people having a shared culture and things that they love and actors that they love. And I think that is why you always feel that kind of reverberation of a death. So on the subject of that, the one thing I'd like to end with is that the other person died this week at a much grander old age was Trevor Griffiths, who was a playwright who I would say really is very much a part of why I love theatre. So Marxist playwright, wrote a brilliant TV series about the Labour Party, Bill Brand. But for me, was sort of, he was one of those playwrights who opened up worlds for me. So I saw Comedians, which was his most famous play, starring Jonathan Pryce, and just thought it was amazing, absolutely amazing. And I remember seeing it and just kind of being so thrilled by it and so thrilled by the arguments it raised about what constituted humour. And who had access to it? Who had the right? Because he was a Marxist, he constantly wrote plays about the working class, about arguments within the working class, about arguments within the Labour Party. But he made them spring to really, really vivid life. And, you know, the party's a brilliant play. He introduced me to people like Gramsci. You know, I never heard of political theorist Gramsci and so on. And he was one of those people, and that's the other thing that I think education should do, is he sent you scurrying off to find out other things because he'd said something that you didn't understand and you had to learn.
Yes.
And I really mourn his passing, and I really wish that people would revive his work. I mean, it's always hard to tell, but I remember them being utterly gripping plays.
Yes.
And I hope that his death does constitute a sort of, you know, a revision of his works. Because I thought they were really fine. But
that's interesting as well, what you say about the lateral side of learning. And that, you know, that for better or worse, all our subjects are defined with very sort of delineated boundaries about topics and what, you know, what umbrellas cover which bits and all the rest of it. But I studied fine art at Leeds, and we had to, in our first year, take other subjects. And one of the things I did alongside history of art was history of science. And I learnt so much that fascinated me. I mean, everything from the miners' strike to, you know, man on the moon to, you know, it was... And not something that you expect to learn studying fine art. But because of the nature of being at university, yeah, and it being a universal education, that was available to me. Bringing it around full circle for all of those reasons that you said about Trevor Griffiths, but also the ripple effect of people's lives, the ripple effect of education and a desire to learn, you know, perpetuates the rest of your life. And people investing in your brain and your imagination and the potential of you affects the rest of your life, because of, you know, the lack of it, the lack of people believing in you, the lack of education, the lack of access to books affects the rest of your life. Yeah. And so, again, it's a big old stamp, as you say, of value and ideology when a government says, this is not important, these people aren't important, this bit of your life needs to be replaced with something that makes money faster.
Yeah.
That will inform people's lives.
It's absolutely true. And there is, floating around on YouTube, which I commend to everybody, an amazing clip from Bill Brand with a very young Jet Shepherd talking as the young left-wing Firebrand taking on his father's achievements in the post-war Attlee government and saying all the things that the Attlee government should have done,
yes,
if it truly wanted to be a socialist government. And it's both a total sort of call to arms at some levels, but also a kind of brilliant example of how all our arguments of politics are circular, and that, you know, you could hear that the people talking about Keir Starmer's policies today are repeating exactly what people felt about Attlee governments. So it's really interesting. And again, it's got an absolute validation of culture. And actually, we might do this in another... It makes you long to see a bit more sort of heavyweight political drama on telly. You know, I do remember that series and... yeah, it's probably a bit slow now, but it does stand up. The arguments stand up.
So. Brilliant.
So that's a good moment to stop.
Yeah, that's it. It's a goodbye from me, Nancy Carroll, the actress.
And a goodbye from me, Sarah Crompton, the critic.